There are 39 milahot, which constitute forms of work forbidden on the Sabbath. It's the why behind the way we do the things we do. Join Rabbi Moshe Schnerb now for Hilchos Shabbos, only on 101.9 High FM.
This is Soul to Soul on your radio, Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Re'eh, Shabbos Mevorchim, Erev Rosh Chodesh, Chodesh Nisan, which Be'ez Hashem will be on Sunday and Monday of this coming week. And a warm, warm welcome to all of our radio family. Thank you so much for joining us, taking the time on this beautiful Erev Shabbos Kodesh to be inspired, hopefully to learn something, hopefully to make this Shabbos the most amazing Shabbos of our lives. Why not? Why not make it the most amazing Shabbos of our lives? And the next Shabbos can be even better. As always, the program today is brought to you as a refuah shalema for many, many cholim amongst Kaisel, Elkanah ben Orit, Avram Yaakov ben Shteinesara, Gershon HaKoyin ben Fredel, ben Shulamis Leah Chaim Alexander, Yehuda Hillel Halevi ben Shulamis Leah, Lana Tevia Bas Rina Bas Reina, Binyamina Bas Yenta, Akava Bas Liba Mina, and Esther Yehudis Chaya Bas Rut Ora Beseich Shor Choli Shomi, all those throughout all of Klaiso who need Yeshua, who need HaKadosh Baruch Hu's special attention and special caress. May they be zeiche, perhaps the schus somewhat of the Torah we're learning together. May they be zeiche to whatever they need, whatever Yeshua, whatever Nachama, whatever Simcha they might need in their lives, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give it to them and give it to them quickly so that they can live the way a Yid is supposed to live. So at the end of the parsha we have a review of the Mayadim, of the Yamim Tovim of the year. And it says, Shivas Yamim Tachoy Glashem Nakecha, 7 days you shall celebrate to Hashem your God, V'ayisa Ach Sameach, and you will be completely, completely joyous. Now, Rashi comments that V'ayisa Ach Sameach is not a command, but rather a promise that we will fulfill the mitzvahs of celebrating the Yom Tov amid joy. Chazal, Gemara Pesachim, on 71a, derive from here that the joy sort of inherent in our celebration of the Yom Tov applies also to the last night of Yom Tov as well. The commentators question how ach, which in Hebrew is used to actually exclude, is used in this context to include the last night of the Yom Tov for joyful celebration. Right? Throughout Shas, however, the word ach is actually used as an exclusion. In a beautiful, beautiful drasha rendered following actually the Holocaust, which, as we know, decimated European Jewry, Harav Shmuel David Valkin Zal addressed this question. He offered a beautiful, beautiful explanation, a very practical approach towards understanding the exception aspect of Ach with regard to Simchas Yom Tov. Says, the preceding pasuk instructed the Jews to celebrate joyfully with family, son, daughter, male or female servants, the Levi, a ger, a convert, orphans, and widows. In other words, it is an exhortation to include the entire Jewish community in festive celebration. What if, chas v'shalom, heaven forbid, one has no one with whom to celebrate? What if, as is presently the sad situation, a major part of Klai Yisrael have been brutally murdered. Is there still a mitzvah to rejoice? Rav Valkin explains that this is exactly what the Torah is teaching us. Ach means someone, something is excluded, missing, which was the case following the Holocaust. Despite the loss, our people must maintain our devotion to Hashem. Our relationship with Hashem is founded in deep-rooted love, a love that is transcendent, in that it transcends adversity and defies logic. Even during the Holocaust, many of our people risked their lives, let's say, to light Hanukkah licht, or to put on tefillin, or keep kosher, and even celebrated Pesach with whatever food they could muster. These were not mere rituals, but declarations of spiritual defiance and deep inner joy. They can bound and persecute us. They can murder us. But at the end of the day, our Jewish soul remains steadfastly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in the valley of death. 11.9 Chai FM. The program is Soul to Soul. We'll be back in a moment with much, much more.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. This is Soul to Soul. Back on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kodesh. Pashas Re'ei Shabbos Mavorchim Chodesh Elu. Re'ei Anaychi Noisan Lefnechem Hayom. What an appropriate parsha for this week. See, I am placing before you today bracha in klala, a blessing and a curse. Es habracha, what is the blessing? Asher tishmu, if you obey the commandments, and a curse if you do not obey my commandments. In a beautiful drasha, in Chodesh Elul 1941, in Warsaw Ghetto, which was kind of passionately rendered to a group of Jews interred in the ghetto. The Piakzana Rebbe Zal focused on the opening psukim of our parsha. Hashem instructs us to see the justice and truth in all things. Blessing for one who obeys and observes, and Hashem curse for one who does not. The result of this perception will be that one will see this day, Hayayim, that Hashem has set before us, that He is behind and involved in everything that goes on in our lives, both blessing and curse. A Jew must believe and perceive that everything happens by the hand of Hashem, and that He does not execute judgment without justice. A reason exists for everything. This is one of the Yud Gimel Ikkum, the 13 principles. Ani mamin be'emunah shleima, I believe without a doubt, she'HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu pays rewards those who observe His commandments and punishes those who violate them. The Rebbe quotes the Bala Tanya, who writes, if a person, while in pain, acknowledges his sins as averus, because everyone knows his own flaws, and sees why this particular punishment was justly dealt him, he will not complain. He will face the brutal truth. He is guilty. Hashem is meting out justice. On the contrary, he will assume that just as Hashem has punished him, so will He nurture him when he regrets his sins and, like a father reconciling with his son, Hashem will comfort him. If a person reflects on his situation, despite the bitter pain he experiences, he will be courageous in his endurance. And ultimately, his mood will also change. Having said this, we now try to address what we call the hestapanim, a concept which sort of weighs heavily on everyone's minds. Hashem is in pain. Hashem is suffering. He understands that Hashem has concealed himself from him. Thus, he feels lost and abandoned. The Rebbe now explains that our idea of hestapanim, the divine concealment, is wrong. Does Hashem not say in Tehillim, Imoy anoichi betzara, I am with you in suffering? Which part of with him eludes our understanding? If he is with us, then he is not concealed. We know in our hearts that he is there, but instinctively, when we are afflicted, when the shadow of hardship and adversity clouds our lives, we kind of sink back, we recoil, we feel abandoned. We despair. And in anguish, we almost unthinkingly ask, where is Hashem? The answer to the question is, Hashem is not hiding his face from us, but rather, our eyes are closed. Pain and affliction distort our vision. Suffering becomes the concern. Instead, a sort of peering through the facade, we look at it. We stop because we have convinced ourselves that nothing is there. Therefore, the Torah gives us a very profound lesson to internalize concerning how we, Re'eh says, look at life. Blessing and curse are not signs of divine presence versus absence. They both come from Hashem, and they are both threads in sort of the tapestry of the Ratzon of Hashem, Allah Kodesh Baruch Hu's will. Hashem is with us all of the time. We have only to open our eyes and look through the curtain. Ostensibly, it takes a great man of a faith whose sort of unwavering devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu offers a powerful lens to sort of pierce the fog, to gain clarity and perceive the reality that he's not alone. Hashem is with him. Well, we often talk about the stories of these great men for the purpose of inspiring those of us who are willing to learn from them. They traverse the roads of adversity, and regardless of the obstacles or the speed bumps along the way, completed their journey, knowing that Hashem was there. He was their sort of their lodestar. Avraham Micholder Weissmandel Zal was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Nitri Yeshiva in Slovakia. He was a towering Talmud Chacham who is remembered for his heroic and desperate efforts to save European Jewry during the Holocaust. He bribed Nazi officials to halt deportation of Jews and sent desperate, detailed letters to Jewish leaders all over the diaspora. And the governments around the world, pleading for action to stop the annihilation of the Jews. He famously warns the world about the mass murders that were taking place in Auschwitz. He had every reason to be broken and angry because he was acutely aware of how much more he could have achieved had the many doors of government and secular organizations under the umbrella of Judaism not been slammed in his face. He persevered and did not allow apathy to prevail. He reestablished the Nitzer Yeshiva, one of the first yeshivas on American soil, modeled after the European predecessor. He lived with profound grief, having lost his wife and children in the war. The unfathomable tragedies of the last decade did not deter him from rebuilding his life. He remarried and had five children. At the bris of his fifth child, Rav Wassmandl rose to address the gathering. He exclaimed the holy words of Kedusha, "Nikadesh Shimcha Ba'olam." I pray that my five sons sanctify your name in this world. In the same manner that my five martyred sons sanctify his name above from heaven. And let them call out and urge one another to say, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvokos, Meloich HaLaretz Kvoido. Holy, holy, holy is Hashem of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. It's 101.9 Chai FM. The program is Soul to Soul. We'll be back in a moment with much, much more.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is Soul to Soul back on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kiddush Parshas Re'eh Tov Shin Pei Hey. As we get ready for an amazing Shabbos, this is Erev Shabbos for Shchodesh Elul. Elul is coming, and we've got to pick up our game. We've got to realize the Melech is Basode, as they say, and let's start. Please God, let's dedicate the next 4 weeks, or we have five Shabbos left, to get ready for the ultimate day of Rosh Hashanah, the day where we stand before the Melech. There's a mitzvah in this week's Pasha. Bon yom atem l'Hashem l'kechem. You are sons of Hashem. Loi siskoididu. Loi siskoididu, there are two different explanations of what the word loi siskoididu means. According to one explanation, it means don't deface yourself over a dead person when you're really in stress. People, unfortunately, some of the other nations of the world sort of make it personal and pull their bodies apart. We don't do that because we are banim atem, we are sons of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we are royalty, and royalty doesn't do things like that. But then there's another explanation. What it brings, and many of the commentaries quote it, Lois Iskodu is Lois Asul at Atzmachem Agudais Agudais. Don't make yourself into small factions, into groups. In other words, the concept of unity, of people getting along with each other, which we need to explore a little bit, because we're going to see how sometimes in the world of Torah, in the world, if you open up a Gemara, you can't go even one side of a folio without meeting at least three different situations where the great people argue. So let's talk a little bit about this contrast. This is a Gemara in Horayos on page Yudalit Amud Alef, which brings that there were two holy, holy Amoraim who were, I guess, competing or running for the office or the privilege of being the Rosh Yeshiva. The two candidates were Rabba and Rav Yosef. Their outstanding qualities was Rav Yosef excelled in the concept of what we call Sinai. He was a person tremendously expert in all areas of Torah. His breadth of knowledge was incredibly, incredibly wide. You know, they would say today, he knew everything. He knew more than AI knows. Rabbah excelled in the fact that he was what we call Oiker Horim. His proficiency was to take a topic and drill deep, deep, deep to the very essence of it, to try to understand all of its reasoning, all of its motivation, all of the sort of the sidelines and deep conceptual grasp of what it was talking about. Right? So these were these two different outlooks in what's the most important part of learning Torah. Rav Yosef, as you said, was in the Shita of Sinai, absolute expertise, trying to finish one Masechta after another until he knew the entire Torah. And in contrast to that, Rabbah held that the concept of pilpul, of deep analysis of all the sources, is what's really, really important. Get as deep as you can into every idea. Try to understand, plumb the depths of the halacha, as they say. Get the reasons, get the logic behind it, whatever stands behind every single opinion in the halacha. So they didn't know what to do. So the Talmidim decided to pose the question to the great, great Rabbonim in Eretz Yisrael. Who should we pick? Should we pick Sinai? Or should we pick Oiker Horim? Which one is preferable? Eretz Yisrael Paskind, pick Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef, who is the one that is Sinai, this great, great expertise, is more important. Why? He says, because everyone needs, you know, you can deep. And build a whole mountain of ideology of thought without realizing that 2 pages later there can be some that might contradict your whole mountain of thought. So it's most important to have this great, great wide knowledge of everything. So, according to this answer, so they should have appointed Rav Yosef as the Rosh Yeshiva. However, Rav Yosef, because he was such a modest person, refused to take the job as Rosh Yeshiva. And therefore, they actually appointed Rabbi Ban Achmeni, that he became Rosh Yeshiva. For the next 22 years, he served as Rosh Yeshiva. And only after the death of Rabbi, Rav Yosef acceded to accept the role of being Rosh Yeshiva, and he remained at the helm for a mere two years. And we need to understand that Rav Yosef's great tzidkut, his great righteousness in being mevater, in sort of foregoing the privilege, the great zchut, the great honor of being Rosh Yeshiva, that's not something so small. Rashi in Maseches Tainis 21 writes, says, Minaku, it's a custom, Mishu Rosh Yeshiva, whoever was the Rosh Yeshiva, Hayu Megadlen Asay Mishalhen. Not only would they make him the greatest Talmid Chacham, they actually physically would give him wealth because he would be respected. A person is more respected, unfortunately, in this world. Physical means makes a big impression, and therefore his colleagues would actually help him, would actually raise him up and give him from their own assets to make him wealthy. And they make him wealthy, as it says regarding the Kohen Gadol, that if, when a person was selected to be the Kohen Gadol, so he's HaKohen HaGadol Me'echav, he was made even greater in all sorts of realms, even the most physical realm, by his brothers. So Rav Yosef not only forgo the honor, forgo the financial perks also, and the covet. So too, it wasn't only a physical loss, it was a spiritual loss. Because the Gemara in Ksuvis on Membeis, it's also the Gemara in Baba Kama, says, Omar Rava says, Hai Milsa Kashoi Be Rabba Rav Yosef. There was this one matter that Rabbi and Rav Yosef found so difficult to understand. For 22 years, they were baffled by it. And they couldn't answer the question until Rav Yosef became the Rosh Yeshiva, and boom, he was able to answer the question. In other words, there's a tremendous, tremendous siyata deshmaya. There's a tremendous divine energy that comes down, a special divine energy, in one's ability to learn and understand Torah. Only when you get that position of being Rosh Yeshiva. Similarly, the whole way he learns is different when you're on that position. Only when you become Rosh Yeshiva. As we see, the Gemara in Nida says that by Rebbe, that since he was the Rosh Yeshiva, he was in charge of the Yeshiva, and the Rabbanon all were around it. So, of course, you're surrounded by other great minds, and you're talking back and forth, and you're asking questions. So that makes him even sharper. It makes you even greater from one's students, from one's colleagues. One learns so much. In other words, the learning of the Rosh Yeshiva is more successful and more, you know, he's able to reach even higher levels when there's all the people, all the other members of the Yeshiva around him. And nevertheless, Rabbi Yosef forgo it all and said, no, I don't want the job. Now, in spite of the fact of the very different opinions in the way they would learn Torah, and the many, many arguments that we find between them. In fact, Rashi in Baba Metzia actually calls Rabbi Lachmeni Bar Pelukdei de Rav Yosef. It's almost like a title he got. He was the sparring partner. He was the one that so often argued with Rav Yosef. We find something very, very interesting. In spite of that fact, they're always fighting, there's something very, very interesting. That Rabbi and Rav Yosef, they spent so much time together. For example, the Gemara in Erevin on Daf Nun Aleph brings down that they would go out. Brings down a story of they once traveled together on the road, and when Shabbos was coming, so they had to stay somewhere. So they actually acquired a place to stay under a particular tree. Similarly, the Gemara in Chulin. And Daf Mem Vav brings a story over there that one time the armies of the ruler arrived in Pumbedisa, and it was a tremendous, tremendous danger. And Rabbi and Rav Yosef decided together that they had to flee together from the city. And on the way, they were met by Rav Zera, and he said to them, right? You who are running away, accept from me the following halacha. The halacha was kizayis sha'amru b'makom mor. It's a particular halacha in laws of treifas. Okay, and Chazal come to teach us this on the tremendous emotional connection that existed of these great holy amoraim in Torah. In every situation, that even in a time of terrible, terrible tzara, right? They were the ones that were learning Torah together. Similarly, we find several times in Shas the sentence, Rabba v'Rav Yosef to Amar Travayu. Rav and Rav Yosef, they said something in unison. They said the same thing. In Maseches Moikotin, on Daf Chazayin, the Gemara says that a mourner on the first day of his mourning, so he should not eat food from himself, but rather other people should provide him with the food. And based on that, the Gemara tells us that when Rabba became an Avel, Nebuch, a relative of his died, Lo Aleinu, so Rav Yosef was the one who provided his food on that day. And then in return, when, unfortunately, Rav Yosef, Lo Aleinu, became an Avel, so then Rabbi Bar Nachmeni brought him those meals, right? So we find that Rabbi and Rav Yosef chose for themselves the same type of work, the same activity that they would both do as preparation and honor for Shabbos Kodesh. Each one of them, right, independently, took a job that they had to do, because we see all the great Tanoim saw it as such an important thing to get involved in the preparation of our Shabbos. Right? Every Tana took for themselves some kind of other act of preparation. And just so happened that Rabbi and Rav Yosef, both of them, did the same thing. They did the same activity for the honor of Shabbos. As Mor says, Rabbi and Rav Yosef, both Rabbi and Rav Yosef, used to cut the wood to make a fire, to be able to cook food on Shabbos, in honor of Shabbos HaMalkus. And even on the day they were Nifter, the Gemara says in Moed Katan, on Daf Chafei on page 25, that by both of them, on the day they passed away, the same thing happened. Right? The mountains that stood above the Euphrates River came together. They kissed each other, as the Gemara says. You know, they kind of, these big, huge piles of stone that supported the bridges above the Nahar Pras leaned over and sort of kissed each other to teach us on the tremendous connection that existed between Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef in their lives. And as we say, b'moisam lo nifrodu, even in their death, they were not separated at all. This has come to teach us an incredibly, incredibly important lesson. Because in spite of the fact that Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi had two completely different outlooks, two different ashkafot, two different views of the way to study Torah, nevertheless, there existed between them a tremendous, tremendous, strong love. Right? And even though we're told that Rabbi and Rav Yosef were bar plukta, they were constantly at each other's throats, they were constantly arguing, nevertheless, that did not in any way negatively affect the love and the peace that existed between them. And that's what Chazal say in four different places, in Masechet Brachot and Nazir and Yevamot and Krisus. Amar Rabbi Lozor, Amar Rabbi Chanina, says Rabbi Lozor, quoting Rabbi Chanina, Talmidei Chachomim Marbim Sholoim Boilam. Scholars, Talmidei Chachomim, increase the peace in the world. As it says, quoting a pasuk in Yeshaya, on chapter 54, V'chol bonayich l'mudi Hashem. Right, all your sons are learned in the ways of Hashem. V'rav shaloim bonayich. And there's huge peace amongst your children. And the one says, don't read it, bonayich, your sons, ela boinayich, the builders of the world. The great builders of the world are the Chachamim. And there's such shalom, there's such peace between them. It would seem that there aren't any greater Balei Machlokes, there aren't people that are more argumentative in the world than the Talmidei Chachamim. Right? How many Machlokes in every single halacha? You can barely find any law in all of Torah where there aren't dissenting opinions. However, the Chachamim, in the way they behave, teaches us something so important, that even if I don't agree or understand the way my colleague is learning something, and we're at loggerheads with each other, nevertheless, that doesn't have to get in the way of our relationship, of a loving, beautiful relationship that can exist between two people, even if they don't agree. We find the Gemara in Masechet Yevamot by Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel that, oh wow, there were many, many tons of different arguments between them in so many different areas of halacha. And even in very, very serious, severe halachot of whether someone can or can't marry another person. Right? They argued. For example, a man betrothed a woman, and he gave her, as is required by law, he gave her something worth the minimal coin to pruta. And afterwards, another man came and gave her an amount of money double, worth much more than what the first person gave. So according to Beis Hillel,
he remains married to the first woman. The kedushin to the second woman does not take effect at all. And therefore, if, God forbid, he would be together with the second woman and have a child, those child will be considered illegitimate, will be considered mamzerim. Beis Shammai, exactly the opposite. He's married to the second woman, and if he would live together with the first one, then those children would be mamzerim, would be illegitimate children. And nevertheless, the Mishnah fixes that even though that these ones say it's also a particular subject is also, and this one says it's permitted, these ones say something is absolutely invalid, and others say it's kosher, still, the families of Beis Shammai and the families of Beis Hillel still intermarried with each other. There was no bad blood, there was no reason why daughters of Beis Shammai's family couldn't marry sons from Beis Hillel, and vice versa. But in any event, we see that it's possible that you could have deep-seated arguments and yet maintain a close friendship. And the question is, how does it work? And how does that save the whole world? There's an incredible Chasam Sofer in his Droshes, where he says he brings a new explanation on this statement of Talmidei Chachomim Marbim Shalom. Talmidei Chachomim increased the amount of peace in the world. Says, in spite of all the many, many arguments that are all over Talmudic literature, he says, Chazal say, Talmidei Chachamim increase peace in the world. What does he mean? Says that, you know, with all the traits that were created in the world by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? So all this, everything was created. There's a midah of busha. There's a midah of embarrassment. There's a midah of chutzpah. There's a attribute of arrogance. There's an attribute of modesty. There's an attribute of peace. There's an attribute of argument. And it's impossible for the world to exist without any and every one of these attributes. And it's impossible that any one of these midot should be uprooted and no longer exist in the world. It's impossible. But we can use them in the right places. Now, machlekes argument is very, very beautiful for those who are learning Torah. And those are fighting back and forth to clarify what the true halach is, right? And this one gives this one has studied the matter, and according to the way he understands it, this is the approach. And this one, using his intellect, comes to another approach, right? Even if they come, and sometimes they kind of force each other to accept the truth, like Shammai and Hillel. And through this, once the midah machlekes is taking place in the world of Torah, then the Yetzara does not have the ability to cause arguments anywhere else in the world. And that's why Marbim Shalom Ba'olam. Because their arguments in the world of Torah save the world from any other type of argument. But unfortunately, when we're not proficiently studying Torah, when we're not fighting for our values, for our ideas, for our opinions, in Torah, and Torah becomes something sort of namby-pamby. Yeah, we don't really get aroused about it, right? So then we get into other things. Then, unfortunately, the physical world, now we start fighting. I want this, and I want this. And we end up in a situation, God forbid, where people have fights. They're fighting over stupidity. They're fighting over money. They're fighting over covet. They're fighting over everything but Torah, because it's impossible to a world without any attributes. And since the machlekes can't be found in the world of Kedusha, and unfortunately it's going to rear its head in other places. But this is 101.9 Chai FM, the program of Soul to Soul. We'll be back in a moment with our Hilchos Shabbos slot.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Here we go, 101.9, Chai FM. This is back on your radio. Erev Shabbos, Great Yish Parshas Re'eh, Tov Shin Pei Hey. We're going to just mix things around a little bit, instead of, as we always do at this point, giving you the special times. We're going to do that, please God, in the last segment. Let's go straight into our study, our discussion of the laws of Shabbos. We are, of course, talking about the laws of lighting fires and extinguishing fires. And this week I want to talk particularly talk about putting out a fire when there is actually danger to human life. Last week we spoke about where there's absolutely no danger to human life, what you are and are not allowed to save and how to do it. But now let's talk about something even more serious. In a situation where human life, again, might be in danger by fire. It doesn't have to be definitely. If there's a possibility that someone, chas v'shalom, could get hurt, that is considered an obligation. It's a mitzvah for anyone who can put it out to actually do so as soon as possible. Why? Since danger to human life overrides Shabbos, overrides everything. Even if the danger is, as I say, uncertain, it's still a mitzvah to put out the fire. For example, if a fire breaks out in a large building, even if it seems that all the residents manage to get out, one must put out the fire as long as there is a possibility that someone may still be inside. Even if the odds are that anyone left inside, God forbid, has already died, since there is still a chance that a rescue is possible, everything has to be done to put out the fire. And that's explicit in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Shin Chav Tes Sif Gimel. Now, in that situation, everything necessary must be done as efficiently as possible on all sort of fronts. Those able to rescue people from the fire should try to do so. And those able to extinguish or at least control the fire should try to do so with whatever means are at their disposal. At the same time, others should call the fire department. If an observer is uncertain whether the fire department has been called already, even if it seems like that someone will have done it, that they have been, he too must call to make sure that they come. Right? Because the possibility of saving lives overrides Shabbos. At such a time, one must not ask a rabbi what to do, but rather move as quickly as possible to help. The overriding rule in that situation is act first, ask later. If there's any possibility of danger, just get busy and do what you need to do. And how you say, let the chips fall where they may. In practice, nowadays, so we treat any large fire that breaks out in a residential building as a life-threatening one. That must be extinguished, even on Shabbos. For example, if a fire breaks out in a block of flats, so there is a concern that it may spread to additional flats, and there may not be time to evacuate the residents of the next buildings. Besides, when there is a large fire, there is no time to check if there are sort of flats with babies, God forbid, or disabled people who maybe can't make their way out on their own. Additionally, some homes contain explosive or gas canisters that endanger people outside the building. Especially considering that fires often attract large numbers of
gawkers, people just standing there looking what's going on. Sometimes it takes longer to clear people out of the area than to put out actually the fire. If the fire is near other homes, it might spread and endanger those residents. Sometimes a fire breaks out in a sort of a storage area containing sort of chemicals, right, whose poisonous fumes may endanger area. These are all calculations one has to make in deciding whether or not one needs to make a move. Some of the poskim even ruled that if sort of terrorists come and they start a fire, that certainly may cause loss of life. So it must be extinguished on Shabbos, right? Because, right, if we don't put it out, so then you want to say that even if there's not necessarily danger to life, the terrorists will feel that they have succeeded and will be motivated to undertake similar attacks and could endanger lives. Again, this is based on Shulchan Aruch, Shin Chof Tes Vav, and it's a sort of a bit of an expansion of the category of a border town, which may be defended against even a property damage on Shabbos. To all sort of, you want to extend it to Israel. I'm not saying that is the halacha, but certainly any situation where there is even a possibility that chas v'shalom lives could be lost, then we have to do everything we possibly can to alleviate such a situation. Now, let's go a bit further. What about a fire to prevent people from being injured? So it's not danger to life, but injuries. So we've already mentioned this before. One who puts out a fire only transgresses a rabbinic law according to most of the poskim. Only one who extinguishes a fire in order to produce sort of charcoal is actually doing what we call a malacha tzuricha legufa, a malacha that is needed for its own sake. When you put out a fire in order to prevent damage from occurring, so he's not actually interested in the act of extinguishing, but in creating a situation in which the fire is gone. Accordingly, this is considered a melacha she'ain tzrucha legufa, melacha that's not needed for its own sake, and therefore is only a downgraded to a rabbinic issur. Therefore, even though Chazal insisted that one may not put out a fire in order to save property, they permitted extinguishing a fire that has the potential to cause mass injury. For example, if there is a burning sort of ember in a public place where many people, right, are liable to be harmed by it, one may remove it even though it is muktzah. If it is impossible to move it, Chazal allowed extinguishing it in order to prevent harm to the public, even though there's no danger to human life. However, in Eretz Yisrael, one shouldn't phone the fire department because their sort of travel very likely involves violating Torah laws in order to prevent possible harm that doesn't involve sort of potential loss of life. So in outside of Eretz Yisrael, where firefighters are usually not Jewish, one may call the fire department, as this only involves the actual violation of a rabbinic prohibition. as the Shulchan Aruch says in Shin Lamed 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 Dalet.
So just to summarize, we have discussed three situations in which one may put out a fire directly or indirectly. Number one, in a situation of danger to human life, it is a mitzvah to do everything possible to save lives, including putting out the fire directly. Number two, in a situation where there is a danger of harm to the public, one may put out the fire, as Chazal did not make their rabbinic rules in such a case. But one may still not violate Torah prohibition to do so. And number three, in a situation where there is sort of just financial loss, but no threat of physical harm to sort of to humans, one may not extinguish the fire. Nevertheless, one may do so via sort of a indirect way. One may also sort of hint to a non-Jew to put out the fire. This is one of the program of Soul to Soul. This is the greatest Jewish radio station all of Africa. We'll be back in a moment with our times and schedules.
This is Hilchos Shabbos with Rabbi Moshe Schnurb, only on 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM, this is Soul to Soul, back on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Re'eh, Tov, Shin, Pei, Hey. Erev Rosh Chodesh, Elul, Tov, Shin, Pei, Hey. As we have our last few minutes together, and as promised, I need to give you the special times you need for this coming Shabbos. So this afternoon, the earliest time for benching lit is 4:38. You can already put on your candles. And again, this is the time to start doing a little bit more. Try to get your Erev Shabbos plans organized and everything in place, and maybe start Shabbos a little bit early. It cannot hurt. It can only gain. It can only enhance your Shabbos, your the atmosphere in your home, the serenity, the beauty. Shabbos overcomes you, and you have an extra chance to sit and read something, sit and talk to the kids, go to sleep if that suits you. But let's go and get Shabbos started as early as possible. 4:38 is the earliest. The latest time for benching licht tomorrow is at 5:33. And even if you can manage 10 minutes earlier, 15 minutes earlier, it's an immeasurable gain that we have to try to chaper on. To try to get. So 5:33 is the latest time for lich benching. Therefore, shkia is at 5:51. So if you're, as we say, 5:33 is our absolute deadline. Those next 18 minutes are only for absolute emergency situations, if need be. And then you can do that. If you want to wait till night and be able to have ma'ariv after it is proper night, so all you have to do is wait till about 6:09. 6:09 is already proper night. Then again, most shuls will be davening ma'ariv after that time. But if you're not, your shul's early, or you're davening not in shul, then just remember, once you say Shema after 6:09, you don't have to repeat it again. Later, you've said Kriya Shema in its correct time, and you have fulfilled your mitzvah altogether. Right, and then of course you're free to sit down and have a wonderful, wonderful meal with the family, with friends. Talk a bit. Talk about the situation. Talk about your week. Talk about something in the Torah, in the Parsha. Talk about whatever it is that's beneficial. Not Chas Hashem, Lashon Hara, not even stupid, banal, useless chatter. Make the Shabbos table a place that is constructive for you and your wife and your children. Make it a beautiful, beautiful time that the kids want to be there also. Tomorrow morning is, of course, Shabbos, Kodesh, Parshas, Re'eh. Re'eh is quite a long Parsha, lots of Rashi, lots of different technical issues in the Parsha. And the Haftarah, in spite of the fact that tomorrow is also Mocher Kodesh, and we do have a special Haftarah often when the Shabbos comes out on the day before Rosh Chodesh. But tomorrow, because we're doing the 7 weeks of comfort, so we're not going to waive the normal Haftarah. We'll say the Haftarah of Rani Akara. Sorry, Ania Saira will be the Haftarah. And then, of course, Rosh Chodesh benching Tomorrow, Rosh Chodesh will be Beis Hashem on Sunday and Monday. Sunday night, we start saying the Dabar Hashem Rav Yishi. Monday, we already blow the Shofar and Shul, and we're on our way into El. Shabbos continues, of course. Whatever beautiful things your Shul does on Shabbos of Orchim, get involved. Shabbos continues. We're going to read Perek Hay in Pirkei Avos tomorrow, and Shabbos Kodesh ends tomorrow night at 6:23. We'll be back, Be'ezus Hashem, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu lets us, to be back next week and speak some more Torah. In the meantime, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being part of our radio family. And to each and every one of you, a wonderful, wonderful good Shabbos. And then right afterwards, a wonderful good Chodesh. Kol Tov.